Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. We're very pleased to welcome you yet again to an OU Kosher pre-Pesach webcast. Baruch Hashem, this is the second pre-Pesach webcast. We had one last year, and now we're zochet to have one yet again. This past year, we also had OU Kosher webcasts on the Kosher Kitchen, on Kashrus in the Workplace, and we're so very pleased that the feedback has been so excellent and that there has been much demand for our continuing these very worthwhile Torah-filled programs. We are privileged again today to have with us Maronon v'Rabonon, Arav HaGoyen Rav Hershel Schechter, Rosh Yeshivas Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan v'Rosh HaKolel, and Arav Yisrael HaLevi Belsky, Rosh Yeshivat Har Vadas, who will be with us in just a few minutes. There are so very many questions that have come in these past few weeks from throughout the country. Today we also received very many more questions from our friends at matzav.com, that very fine and sophisticated website that is always filled with Hashkafas HaTorah and Hayahadus. We're pleased that they have joined with us. They've also put on a link for live link into the webcast now. We're going to begin with questions for Rav Schechter so that we get the program underway, and then when Rav Belsky comes in, he will join with us. Rav Schechter, we were asked, can you please explain the differences between the various types of matzah, machine matzah, 18-minute matzah, shmura matzah? And someone even sent in today whether there are any issues to be concerned about the wheat from Arizona. Is there an issue?
Well, the main difference is between shmura matzah and regular matzah. Shmura matzah is much more expensive because it requires much more supervision. The shmura matzah, from the time that the wheat is harvested from the ground, it's watched and supervised, put in packages to make sure that it doesn't come in contact with any water, that it doesn't become chametz. There are two opinions in the Talmud whether this is necessary for the purpose of fulfilling the mitzvah by the Seder. Do you have to have shmura matzah or not? And we are machmir. It's the stricter opinion, we are machmir, to require shmura matzah. It's much more expensive than a regular matzah. If a person simply doesn't have shmura matzah available, we would assume that he can use regular matzah and say brocha l'achilas matzah on that. That's the main difference between the shmura matzah and the regular matzah. Then, the shmura matzah is supposed to be baked l'shmo, for the sake of fulfilling the mitzvah. So this was a big question in Europe. If you push a button on a machine and everything goes automatically, it's all set up by automotion, is that considered asiya l'shmo? So most were of the opinion that yes, and there was a minority opinion that not, that it's only called asiyah l'shma, making it for the sake of the mitzvah, if someone actually does avodas hayad. That's the same question regarding tzitzis. If you have wool that's made into strings by machine, is that considered asiyah l'shma, or would you require dafka avodas hayad, that it should be spun into thread by hand? So the accepted opinion is that even if it's done by machine, it is considered, if the one who pushes the button on the machine is a Jewish person who's obligated to keep the mitzvah of tzitzis, so to keep the mitzvah of matzah, and he pushes the button, l'shem mitzvah matzah, so in most cases that would be considered asiyah l'shma. The 18-minute matzahs, that's another story. The definition of chametz is that you have to make sure the matzah is not chametz. Now, the definition of chametz is if you have one of the five kinds of grain, wheat, barley, oats, rice, spelt, that came in contact with water and it sits there for a long enough time, then it turns into chametz. So how long is a long enough time? So the Talmud says if it sits, if you have the flour mixed with the water for less than a shear mil, the amount of time that it takes to walk a mil is much less than a mile, so then, mil is alpay mama. So then, if it's less than a mil, for sure it didn't become chametz. If it's more than a mil, then you have to begin to think that maybe it became chametz. So how long is that period of time, the shear mil? So the Mishnah Berurah, in this commentary on Shulchan Aruch, usually assumes that that's 18 minutes. So because less than 18 minutes, for sure, there's no problem of chametz, that's why many have a chumra, a hidur, that they'll only use the first 18 minutes of matzahs from the factory, or many yeshivas will go bake matzahs in a matzah factory where everything, you push a button, everything goes automatically. So they'll stop the machinery every 18 minutes and they'll clean everything out and start all over again. Why? Because when you use a machine to manufacture matzahs, usually a little, all the time, not usually, all the time, a little bit of dough will accumulate. Because the matzahs go on a conveyor belt and then they cut off the stuff on the side. And then some of the dough will always accumulate and sit there for a while. Then it's going to fall back into the rest of the dough. So some of the dough that accumulates, if it sits there for more than 18 minutes without any hisaskos, without any movement, without any anybody banging it or doing anything to it, so then there's a concern that it may turn into chametz. Basically, it's not really a problem because the stuff is always moving. The dough is always moving and something's shaking and something's happening to it. But because there is such a far-fetched possibility, maybe some of the dough will accumulate and sit there for more than 18 minutes and turn into chametz, and then it's going to fall back into the rest of the matzah. So the truth of the matter is, even if it does fall back in, we paskin that it's going to be bottle. Chametz that gets mixed into Pesach dika food on Pesach, chametz is b'mashu. But if the chametz falls into Pesach dika food before Pesach, then we paskin that it's bottle b'shishim. So even if a little bit of dough did turn into chametz and it did fall back into the matzahs, so strictly speaking, it would be bottle b'shishim. But because there's an opinion in Shulchan Aruch that we say chayzev an ear, that even if some chametz became bottled before Pesach, when it comes Pesach, it becomes on Erev Pesach, you can eat it, but we don't eat matzahs on Erev Pesach. So on Erev Pesach, it would be bottled, and then when it comes Leil Pesach, it'll again be b'mashahu. So that's why many have the practice of insisting on 18-minute matzahs. So these are hidurim on top of hidurim. We are mahadir to have dafke shmur matzah, which is put into, placed into a plastic bag from the time they harvest it from the ground. And then many amahada to insist dafke on hand-baked matzahs. Many insist that it's preferable to have machine matzahs because the whole process, when it's done by machine, takes much less time than when it's done by hand. So there are many in Yerushalayim and in America also, there are many Hasidim and Shemaisa who insist dafke on using machine shmura as opposed to hand shmura. And many have the practice, no, they want to have dafke hand shmura that to make sure that that's called asiyah l'shma because of the other issue as to whether pushing a button and everything happens by machinery, is that considered l'shma or not? And then many have a hider on top of that, that you want to have dafke 18-minute matzahs to make sure that the it's impossible to be concerned about the possibility that a little chametz, a little sum of the dough accumulated and fell back in.
As always, I want to welcome my chaverim, Rabbi Eli Gerstein, who is the OU rabbinic coordinator, recorder of the psak of the OU poskim, and my dear chaver and colleague, Rabbi Elio Farrell, who works with me so diligently and consistently on all of the very many OU kosher educational programs. We're very pleased that Rav Belsky has joined us now so that we have our full team and we're ready to move at full steam. Rav Schechter, someone asked, I recently cleaned out my mom's house and have found several boxes of dishes. I know which were milchik and which were fleishik, but all were used with chametz, but not used in probably over 20-25 years. Can they be used for Pesach? If so, do I have to keep them fleishik if they were previously fleishik, milchik if they were previously milchik? What about in regard to pots and pans, silverware and glassware?
By dishes, I assume that we are referring to China dishes. China, we usually assume, cannot have hagola. So if you have China dishes that we use for chametz, we assume you cannot do hagola. You cannot kasher them by putting them into burning hot water. Now, there was an opinion of one of the gedolim in the 1700s, the Chacham Tzvi is of the opinion, based on a source in the Talmud, that any trefa pot or any trefa dish that hasn't been used at all for 12 months need not be kasher at all. The Talmud says this regarding rare instances, and the opinion of the Chacham Tzvi has not been accepted. We assume that it doesn't apply all over. So we would assume that these China dishes that became chametz 25 years ago will remain chametz dik. Now, regarding the pots and the pans, that a person can kasher if you have chametz dik. In the days of the Talmud, the people couldn't afford to buy separate pots and pans for Pesach and separate for all year long. So they used to kasher all the pots and pans when it came Pesach time. So that's perfectly okay. The only thing is we have a Ashkenazim have a minhog. The Mogen Avraham in his commentary on the side of the Shulchan Aruch quotes a minhag from Ashkenazim that we don't kasher from fleshik to milchik and milchik to fleshik. The Sfardim clearly don't have such a minhag. And even some Ashkenazim claim, the Aruch HaShulchan claims that there never was such a minhag. He doesn't think there is such a minhag. But most people usually assume that that is the minhag. So all year long, if you want to switch from fleshik to milchik, we don't allow that. But once you're kashering ready for Pesach, you're allowed to kasher the chametz dik and milchik pots or the chametz dik and fleshik pots for Pesach. Once you're kashering for Pesach, then you can already switch, the Chasam Sofer said, you can switch to use the fleshik for milchik and milchik for fleshik. But if you don't plan to use the pots and pans for Pesach, you have chametz dik and pots and pans that are fleshik, and you haven't used them in 25 years, and you remember that these were, this is my mother's pots and pans, I remember that these were the fleshik pots. So I think it would, even though in my home, we never used it for fleshik, my mother's home. But if I remember clearly that these were fleshiks, I think it's usually assumed that it's not proper to switch it over, to kasher it over from fleshik to milchik or the reverse.
Also, Rav Shechter, in regard to the kitchen, must I have new dedicated dish towels for Pesach, or may I wash my regular ones and use for Pesach?
No, we don't have to have separate dedicated dish towels. No, you just wash them out well, and you use them for Pesach. I don't think that's a problem.
Also in the kitchen, which kitchen surfaces must I cover?
Which kitchen?
Surfaces.
Well, if you kasher a surface, then you don't have to cover it. If you don't want to kasher the surface, is it necessary to cover it? So if there's a possibility that you're going to clean it off, there aren't going to be any particles of any chametz on top. So if you think that you may be putting some hot Pesach dika food on it, then you should cover it. But either cover it or kasher it. But if you're not in the practice of putting hot Pesach dika food on and you cleaned it off very clearly, very obviously clean, so there's no particles of chametz bien on the surface, then there's no need to. If you're going to use it for cold food on Pesach, then there's no need to cover or to kasher the surfaces.
Let me remind our audience yet again that questions can still be emailed to farrell.e@ou.org, and we'll be pleased to look at them even during this webcast. I also want to remind our audience that last year we had a pre-Pesach webcast that dealt with many, many issues of kashering and many related Pesach shilas. That webcast is archived and posted on www.oukosher.org and OU Radio, and you can please look for that and enjoy the enormity of the Torah that we shared last year. Rav Belsky, I have a question regarding the use of quinoa for Pesach. Is quinoa considered kitnios? I understand that some kashrus agencies permit quinoa and others do not. What is our opinion on this? In our last webcast on the kashrus in the workplace, I believe the most popular question was regarding microwaves in the office. This time in the webcast, I believe the quinoa question is the most popular.
The question of which species are considered kidneys and which are not is not something that we have to trouble ourselves so desperately to be machmir about, because kidneys is a minig, a very important minig, and of course we go to all kinds of expenses and troubles not to use kidneys in Pesach in our food. But nevertheless, when there's questions of, and there are two sides to the question, is we could be maker and we could say that this particular species is not kidneys. With that short introduction, let me get to the point. What is kidneys? The word kidneys means peas. It's expanded to mean beans. And that means that people from Ashkenazi communities don't use beans or peas or rice and sesame seeds and a number of other items in their Pesach menu, and it shouldn't be l'chatchila mixed in with the food, and nor should we use oils that are squeezed out of these species. That's the minhag throughout the European Ashkenazi community. The Achrayim, the latest authorities, define kidney as in three different standards. One is the Taz says an item that has seeds which are similar in shape and size and appearance to seeds of the grain that we use, the five kinds of grain, wheat, barley, oats, rye, spelt. Another one is that it produces a flour which is similar to the flour that we produce from wheat, the common flour that's used. And third is that the kidney is something that undergoes a process of cleaning similar to the process that's used for grain. That process is called digun. The word digun means the process that makes something become dogon. Dogon is the word in the Torah meaning grain. What is digun? Well, how to say that? That digun means that digun means to gather seeds together and whatever it is. I'll tell you precisely what digun means. It means that when you have a large number of seeds, there are certain wholesale ways to blow them into the wind or whatever it is to clean out the chaff and to clean out the dirt so that they could be purified and cleaned and used for food. That's a process called digun. Now, which seeds are included under this heading? So we say beans. Why? Because beans could be ground into a flour and used similar to the flour that comes from grain. There are other seeds that a certain type of kimmel seed, which the Taz says is similar to wheat. It looks like wheat, therefore it falls into the other category. And there are other things that undergo a process called digun. It's impossible for us to use these definitions on our own and just decide which things are kidney is because there are so many things that fit into one definition or another, and on our own we might decide, well, this is kidney, this is not kidney. The way to clarify the question of what is kidneys and what is not is by looking at the things that have been considered kidneys and that have been forbidden from use in the Ashkenazi communities in the last few hundred years by the authorities. Coriander, for instance, is a nice little seed, but it's definitely not kidneys because the Achrayim all say like that. They say that the coriander, which is the little round seed that's in the pickle jar, the pickling circular seed, which is, by the way, the Zera God mentioned in the Torah. That's not kidneys. Anise seed is, again, not kidneys. That's what the authorities say. The other kind of kimmel, fennel, and cumin, that's not kidneys because they tell us that only one kind that looks like a wheat seed is kidneys. So as you could see, kidneys is not something that is extended to everything. Today there are people who say perhaps that cotton seed is kidneys and therefore cotton seed oil is forbidden for Pesach. The general Ashkenazi community in Europe didn't accept that. The great Poskim in America, Moshe Feinstein and all the others, didn't accept that. They use cottonseed oil and it's considered l'chatchila, not kidneys, and there's no place to be mahadir and to be more strict about it. But what about quinoa? Well, it a new vegetable. It's something that hasn't been heard of before. And some would like to say, well, look, after all, it hasn't been around in the early generations, and how could we just go ahead and make it also now? That's the opinion of others. But on the other hand, we all accept the fact that American corn, sweet corn, which they call in the rest of the world maize, that's we consider that to be kidneyous. We don't use corn syrup or flour made from corn, cornstarch. It's all a no-no. It's forbidden on Pesach as kidneyous, even though it wasn't around. It's in the world vegetable. It came after Columbus. It wasn't known to the Jewish world before that. So this isn't the rule that's absolute. Now let's, and with all this in mind, let's take a look at quinoa. Quinoa is processed a lot differently than wheat. Probably you can't call that it has digun, because whatever process digun is, which you could define many different ways, as I said before, it probably doesn't apply to quinoa. It's a very different type of process. The shape of the seeds may be similar to wheat, maybe not. But one thing is definitely true. It produces a flour which is used exactly in the same way that wheat flour is used. Muffins and cakes and all kinds of foods made from flour are processed from quinoa. In the countries where it's a popular foodstuff, it's used very often in the way that we use grain flour in this country. And as such, I feel that that's the most important consideration when it comes to the kidneys. It's a seed, so it's similar to bean and corn and all the rest of those. Not like potatoes, which are a large fruit. Potatoes also were discussed 200 years ago. The Hayyadim and others felt that perhaps we should forbid potatoes as kidneys. Potatoes are also a New World vegetable, which was first discovered here in America long after Columbus. And yet, the world didn't accept that potatoes should be called kidneys, and one of the staples on Pesach is potato flour. But potatoes is a large vegetable, and quinoa is a seed, and it's processed aside. We don't know if we could call it digun, we don't know about the shape, but what we do know is that it produces a flour which is used in exactly the same way as wheat flour. And I feel that it should be considered kidneys. But on the other hand, there are people who feel it shouldn't be considered kidneys, and that's the sack that certain rabbonim in different places say.
Most of the questions that came in this regard, Rebelsky, related to people that were concerned about it for health reasons. Is that if there was, consequential to the children?
Definitely, because if it's for health reasons, since there are two sides to the question, that's how I started the discussion. So they have what to rely on, and they could continue using it. But if it's not for health reasons, so then find something else to substitute during Pesach. But if they need it, they're allergic to potatoes or whatever else there is.
Or digestive problems.
Digestive, same thing. They need it. Many people get upset stomachs by eating anything differently than the special regimen that they're accustomed to. And they got to be very careful. And we can't, if there are two sides to the question when it comes to kidneys, they should and have every right to and are responsible to themselves to use the quinoa. But if someone doesn't have any compelling reason to use it, to my mind, it's more kidneys than almost everything else. I've heard arguments why cotton seed oil should be kidneys. I don't see any valid reason. I've heard arguments linseed oil should be called kidneys, and I don't see any reason for that. But be that as it may, quinoa is much more within the original parameters of kidneys than anything else that I know. However, again, there are two opinions, and anyone who has a compelling reason should. By the way, those who are going to use kidneys of any kind should make sure that it's kosher le Pesach. For instance, Sfardim eat rice because Sephardim don't keep away from kidneys. And in Sephardic families, rice are used. In fact, the Gemara tells about using rice for the Seder on Pesach, that it's one of the staples. Kim Aroizer. Yet you got to be careful, because all of the rice that's sold commercially in America is enriched, and all the enrichment contains chametz. So you have to get special rice that's not enriched, and there are special productions made for Pesach. But the rice is enriched. I know that the OU went to tremendous lengths to work with producers and merchants to make available for the public non-enriched rice, so that the Sephardic community could have rice without a trace of chametz in it. And it was practically a disaster, a failure, the attempt, because most of the people for whom it was prepared preferred a different company's rice, Carolina rice, as opposed to the other rice, which they said wasn't of the high quality. Well, the other rice that we produced without enrichment was Goshal Pesach. Carolina rice had enrichment. Legally, rice has to be enriched. It's a government requirement. The reason is because polished rice, which is rice with the bran and everything is removed, lacks all the vitamins. It has the starch, it has the food value, it has everything, but not vitamins. And a person could, if he has polished rice, that's his diet, so he could be diseased, beriberi this. It's I believe the first discovery of the existence of vitamins was made when it was noticed that the rich Chinese who ate polished rice, as opposed to the poor who ate rough rice with bran, the poor were 100 times healthier than the rich people, because the others had no vitamins and the poor had all the vitamins. So the government, since that time, requires enrichment. So we have to have special productions. And the same thing with this quinoa. I'm not totally familiar with what there is. I don't believe that quinoa is enriched, but it should be checked into. It is kosher.
We'll have to go through a few questions relating to cleaning for Pesach. We'll go through them rather quickly. They're short. If I will be away the entire Pesach, do I need to prepare anything in my house, Belsky?
If you'll be away the entire Pesach, so I just like to express myself over here. Many people today figure, well, I'm going away for Pesach, and one of the main reasons to go away is to get rid of the huge strain of Pesach cleaning. I'll leave the house as is, loaded with chametz and crackers and bread and everything, and I'll sell the entire house, plus the food and the crumbs all over and the dirt that's attached to the walls and the kelim, and with one swift stroke, no more chametz, no bedika, no cleaning, no trouble, and finished, I'll go off to a hotel. And the trouble is that the house is really your house. To sell a house is not a simple thing at all. To sell a closet filled with chametz, okay, that's one thing. So you go through, you make the kinyonim, and make sure you have a capable job who sells it, you know, with all the different methods that one has to do in order to sell these items. But to sell a home requires real estate, and if you rent out the home to someone else and they move in before Pesach, so then they're mechuyev in bedika. Good. But if it's your home and no one else moved in, so you're mechuyev in bedika, unless you sell the house. And then there are most requirement that if you have no house, if you live in a caravan on Pesach, so you still got to leave over something in the house to make bedika. So people commonly say today, in our age of comfort and ease and trouble-free lives, they say, well, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to sell the house. I'll make a little kinyan, know my house, and I'll We put aside one room so that I should be yotze with the mitzvah of b'dikas chometz. Well, if the house is sold in a valid way, which is very difficult to do, and there's one room left aside, it has to be a room that's a mokim shemachnisin b'chometz, otherwise there's no mitzvah of b'dikin, so you aren't mekayim anything at all by leaving over that room. So people who are young and healthy should put in a little bit of effort. They don't have to make a spring cleaning. They don't have to scratch, wash down the walls. They don't have to spend weeks preparing and cleaning. They could dispense with all that, even if they live in the house, Kolshkin, if they go away to a hotel. But they should clean up 1, 2, 3, and go around and make with the chametz the night before they leave for their vacation. If it's Erev Pesach that they leave, then the night before they should be boiling chametz with a bracha. And if it's not Erev Pesach, then they'll be boiling chametz with a candle or a searchlight or whatever it's going to go to do. And it should be done without a bracha. And it could be done without the massive effort that discourages people from cleaning the house. Just a minor effort, enough just to sweep the floor and to herd all the chometz perhaps into a closet or two so it could be sold in a legitimate mechira, and the house is your house and be by the kid. But if someone's old or sick or burdened by some very special burden which makes it difficult for them to impossible, so there are rabbonim who will be able to make a legitimate mechira. It takes a little effort, but it could be done. And the apartment could be sold, and they could make b'dikah in the hotel if they come there a day earlier. Since no one made b'dikah till then with the churin of the stocken, no one looked with or haner, so they have a right to make the b'dikah even if they moved in the day before Pesach. All these things should be done, but the wholesale attitude that some people have, they'll just dump the whole union of b'dikah and cleaning and everything, with a flick of the hand, get rid of the house. They're not getting rid of everything, anything. The house is there, and people come in, they're a whole Pesach, and if no one comes in, it's all the same. It's their house, they live there, and they have to make a bedikah, like the Masech Tepsachim begins, with the famous word that ring in our ears, Or Lar Boser, Boitken Asacham Is Lar Haner, and that's for all of us, we're all getting old, and maybe one day it'll come when I'll have to do the same thing, but I hope Bezos Hashem that everything is I could always be by the comments in my own home.
Bezos Hashem. Rav Shechter, exactly how does one know if a certain room in his house is considered a place shemachnisim bo chometz, is a place where he brings chometz for bedika? If one brings chometz into one area of a room but not to the other, does he need to search the entire room or only that part?
Well, I think the opening Mishnah Pesachim speaks about a big wine cellar where the waiter in the middle of the meal may sometimes go in order to fetch some extra wine. So you only have to avoid that part of the room where you think that there may have fallen some chum. You don't have to avoid the rest of the room. Some of the rooms in the house, we know. Let's say there's a room where there's a computer. And people, if you have children who nash while they're working on the computer, or you have adults who nash while they're working on computers, so it's a mokum shemachnis chametz. Certain bedrooms, certain rooms, you know that you don't bring a chametz. You don't have to be choshish that maybe once a year. You can tell which rooms yeah, and which rooms no.
Is it a b'di'evit to use a flashlight for b'dikas chametz?
I don't think so. I think we would assume that it's even good l'chatchila. Originally, when they came out with electric bulbs in Europe, so the Marsham was of the opinion that lighting an electric bulb on Shabbos was only a melacha midrabbanan. So to demonstrate, Rab Chaim Oysen wanted to demonstrate that he didn't agree, that he felt that turning on an electric bulb on Shabbos constituted a melacha deraisa. So the Rab Chaim Oysen went out of his way to dafke say bar miyari hoesh on an electric bulb. We assume an electric bulb is regularly a fire. It's aish, it's havara. Or on there, it's good for bedikah.
I will need to work at my desk job during Chol HaMoed. It's probable that no one else goes to my desk while I'm not there. But it's also possible that a cleaning crew might set down or spill a beverage, drop crumbs from a snack, Is it sufficient to cover the surface of my desk with paper towels when I eat lunch during Chol HaMoed, or must I take some additional precautions?
I would assume it's certainly sufficient. It's more than enough. If they put paper towel on the desk, I don't think they even have to put a paper towel unless you think that there were some crumbs there. I don't think we have to be paranoid about the far-fetched possibility that someone dropped some crumbs on my desk. It's avadik, but if you put paper towel in.
Ravelsky, what do I need to be aware of in terms of items traditionally in a medicine cabinet as far as Pesach is concerned? Tylenol, toothpaste. We just got a question in a few minutes ago. My Lanta.
First and foremost, we should just focus on the stuff that's edible. There are children's medicines which are all edible. You know, the liquid infant children's Tylenol and a whole bunch of those. There's cough syrups which are edible for adults. But the cough syrup has to be swallowed and cover the surface of the throat, take away the pain, and to help cure the cough somehow. And these medicines contain lots of alcohol, and it could very well be grain alcohol, which is chametz. So it's stuff like that that's really the main focus of things in the medicine closet. The pills which
are... Could one generalize that specifically all liquid medicines?
Yes, all liquid medicines are like... The first assumption is that it very well might be chomet. We have, you know, all these lists that are, some of them are prepared by experts, and they're very, very helpful. And they do have certain items which have no grain alcohol, and they've been checked out very thoroughly. So you should consult the list. But things which are edible are foods. They're not nisul me'achila at all. They're made to be eaten and to be enjoyed while they're eaten. They may put in a little drop of something that gives it the feeling of having a medicine so that the person shouldn't think to himself, this stuff is worth nothing, all the money that it paid for it. Why? Because it tastes too good for the medicine. But whatever it is, it's still not nisul me'achila. Pills, bitter pills, generally are things that you have to take. And there's no achshave. In other words, we don't do anything to it by swallowing it that should make it to be considered edible and considered a food. So whatever the contents are, the bitter pills are acceptable. When it comes to vitamins, there's a serious question, because vitamins could possibly be considered a food supplement, because when people take all these vitamins, mostly unless they have some kind of vitamin therapy, they're taking it not as a medicine, but as a substitute for the nutrients that have been depleted out of the food that we eat, and because of that, we don't have the medicines, the vitamins that we need. This is the thinking that goes along with most vitamins. I'm not commenting how true it is. That's all important right now. But that is the thinking that goes along with taking vitamins, and the people who swallow it are thinking of it as a food supplement. That's why, you know, there was a very, very great poisik in America, and he's largely forgotten among the younger generations because he didn't leave the wealth of the Yerusha that Moshe Zatzal left. But he was, before Moshe, the leading poisik in America, and this was Yosef Elio Henkin. Rav Henkin held that when you swallow something, it's considered an act of that demonstrates that it's a food. Because if you want to eat matzah and all you do is swallow it, and I don't chew it, and you don't taste it, it's considered like eating. You yotze with the mitzvah of achilas matzah. So he said that therefore any swallowing should be considered an act that designates the item that you swallow as a food. Most poskim disagreed with it, but when it came to vitamins, Moshe says that there is a very strong case to support Rav Henkin's opinion that a vitamin, which is eaten as a food supplement, and it's the part of the meal that somehow was you were deprived of when they prepared the food. So you have to get in that last little bit of the meal that you intended to eat. So swallowing it is considered using it as a food, and therefore you got to have a hechsher on the vitamins and make sure to, you know, pack them up with the chometz and sell them or whatever it is that you do to get rid of them. Tashbisus army botechem. So you should make sure that they're out of the house and out of your possession on Pesach. There are no Pesach vitamins. The vitamin companies just don't make them. Once in a while you find some kind of Pesach vitamins, but I guess it's not financially worth their while or whatever. So you just have to figure out which foods contain the nutrients, and that might help you more than the little pills, probably, you know. But that's the part of the medicine chest. And then again, there's other stuff in the medicine chest. There's rubbing alcohol, for instance. So if you look at a bottle, most alcohol, isopropyl alcohol is not, it's petroleum derived. The most alcohol used, which are edible, is either what we call denatured. Denatured means that something is put into them to make them thoroughly disgusting, that the person would just throw it up if he took it in his mouth. That's what, whenever it says SD alcohol. SD alcohol isn't a type of alcohol. It means specially denatured alcohol. So that stuff is really nisal mechilus kelev, ligamri. When you have, and most of it is made from corn. So there's no balirua, there's nothing wrong with keeping corn products. It's only eating that we can rub our skin with corn product. There's no issue, there's no minig of kidneys and using it for anything but food. So, in fact, in the time of the Achronim, they had lamps, oil lamps, made from oil of kidneys on the table. And they weren't concerned that a little droplet of oil will fall into the food, which is being eaten by the Seder. So, you could rub your skin with corn-derived alcohol. In any alcohol made in Europe, you could assume that it comes from grain, and it's chometz. So no one should have any product that has alcohol, which is made in Europe, including perfumes. Perfumes are not nifsel mechila. No one has any interest in possible mechila. The little bit of alcohol that's in it is not denatured. And it's made in the U.S. It's surely made from corn alcohol, corn-derived alcohol, and it's no problem keeping it. But if it's made in Europe, it's made from grain-derived alcohol.
So we did have several questions, Ravelsky, about alcohol. So you're responding now.
Okay.
Also about non-edibles, Ravelsky, several have asked regarding paper plates, paper napkins, paper goods. Are they acceptable without being labeled kosher LePesach?
There has been, in experience of the last couple of decades, or who knows how long, paper or plastic which have been doused with a powder, and even a chometz-derived powder, in other words, a wheat starch layer. I know of no such thing in recent years. The paper plates that we have are not chometz stick. The paper towels that we have are not chometz stick. There were questions that were asked concerning them by very, very serious and concerned Arbonim in the past couple of decades, who were worried about having the paper thickened by starch and all that. We've not found anything to support any worry about these items. But there are, surprisingly, non-edibles, which you could be over by your own, by your mate, by their eyes. I'll tell you a very interesting one. You have a little innocent box that says vinyl paste. Vinyl paste. What's ketchup zayin? Vinyl paste. Vinyl means plastic, you know. The box of vinyl paste, by the way, if you're making a cake and you run out of flour and you need another cup of flour, you could empty that box of vinyl paste into the flour because it's just pure flour. I don't know what kind of vinyl paste, but if it's the typical wallpaper layers, the professional men's paste, he doesn't have any preparation made for the homeowner who can't prepare his own stuff. It's flour. That's all it is. It's flour mixed with water, and it could be eaten. It's roi lachis l'mamash. You have another item, which we could talk about that one from many angles. Some kind of roach or mice poison. Some of that stuff is solid wheat grain, and it could very well be chometz. And by the way, it's not poisonous for a human being. It's only poisonous for a mouth. It's very medicinal. The poison that they use is called coumadin, warfarin, and it's a very common medicine. In the doses that it's used to kill the little creatures, it's harmless to a human being. So I would be very careful about that. You really can't go and get into the little holes all over the house or call back your exterminator to remove the stuff. There you'll have to be mafkirit or something. And maybe it's nimas by lying on the ground for a long time, and who knows. I don't think the person who put it there is really mafkirit. He wants it to be there. Every time he sees that little plate with the grain in it, he feels confident that he's being protected. Hopefully he finds more protection in the mezuzah on the door, but that stuff is edible grain. So there are items that are non-edible, which really are edible. Put it this way, if they were actually non-edible, there would be nothing to talk about. But if they... They may be edible. You just should check out anything. I found the vinyl paste is something that no one in the wildest dreams imagines, that it may be just a box full of pure chametz. And they don't do anything to make it inedible, by the way. And the only things that people make specially inedible is the alcohol, and that's a government requirement. Why? Because they charge a tremendous tax on edible alcohol, and the producers of these products, in order to avoid paying the tax, have to denature them so that the government shouldn't collect the tax.
A number of questions came in just an hour ago through our friends at matzav.com, Rav Schechter. There seems to be a number of confusing shitas when it comes to kashering kitchen sinks and ovens. If one has a self-cleaning oven, is there really a need to self-clean more than once?
To self-clean more than once? Mm-hmm. I don't think so.
I agree.
Novelsky agrees. That's a good short one. Some have a custom of using an oven insert. Does this have a halachic basis on a kashered self-cleaned oven, or is it just a remnant of the pre-self-cleaned days?
I think that's only if you don't have a self-cleaning oven. You didn't kasher it. So then the practice, many, many Orthodox people would put in an insert in the oven to bake everything for Pesach in the insert.
Same question with stainless steel sinks. If the sink is properly kashered, is there a halachic need for an insert?
The way we usually kasher a stainless steel sink is by taking a kettle of burning hot water and pouring it on the sides of the sink, because whenever the trefa blia here, it's chometz, whenever the trefa blia was absorbed in the sink, the irui, by pouring from a burning hot kli rishon, so then the hagola can be done on the irui. Now in the sink, once in a while, the balabasta is making cooked spaghetti. Sometimes a chunk of a spaghetti that's burning hot will fall on the sink. So that has many amachma, that's more chomer than irui. Since it's a dova gush, it's a solid particle, so some consider that like a kli rishon. So hagola, the irui, wouldn't be sufficient. So that's why many have the practice, even after kashering the stainless steel sink by pouring burning hot water from a kettle, they'll still put either a tray on the bottom, either a plastic tray or a some insert in the bottom to make sure that the dishes are not really touching the sink. All the chametz was nivla more than 24 hours before Pesach, but we're machmer, the Ramah is machmer on that, even b'dieved, that a blia, that Zeinah ben Yomo is considered nois and tam l'gam. When nois and tam l'gam on Pesach, even us is b'dieved. So this is, we're machmer for that. So even if you do kasha the stainless steel sink, more correct is, you should still use an insert.
Just a few moments ago, several questions came in. And my dear friend Rabbi Farrell wrote to me that this is a great question, so we need to ask it. I do recall looking at these two questions, that similar questions were asked last year in the pre-Pesach webcast, and I remind our audience again that is archived on OUradio.org. It could also be downloaded to your iPod. So if you travel, if you're in the subway, if you're in a car, you can listen to it and enjoy and learn so very much from last year's Pesach Torah. The question, Rav Shechter, is regarding toys for young children. To what extent does one have to clean or check for chametz? Does one have to check each toy car or each Lego block to see if there's any chametz be'en, such as a piece of cereal that the kid threw in there? If there's something stuck to the toys, does one have to scrape it off?
I would think if the children play with Cheerios or eat Cheerios while they're playing with the toys, there is a concern that they may have some Cheerios stuck that are still edible. I would think that the parents either have the responsibility to see to it that all year long the children don't eat the nash while they're playing with the toys, or they should wash all the toys off before Pesach. Okay. Yes?
And for the adults, regarding Sfarim, to what extent does one have to clean or check for chametz? Does one have to check each page? Only Sfarim that are known to have been used at the table during the year, only Sfarim that will be brought to the Pesach table. What is the basic guideline?
I never eat while I use Sfarim. I don't want to get any crumbs on any Sfarim, so I never check any Sfarim. But other people are such big masmidim that they'll be learning all the time, even while they're learning in the Sfarim. So they should shake out the practice used to be. People would shake out the Sfarim. I don't think they open every single page. They'd lift up the safe and shake it out to get all the crumbs out, to make sure that even if they're not using the safe on the table on Pesach, they don't want to have the crumbs in their possession on Pesach.
A very contemporary Shaila from the same person who asked the previous two. Given the present economic conditions, Rav Belsky, at the end of the last webcast, Rav Belsky commented profoundly on the stock market conditions and so forth. So perhaps I'll give this to Rav Belsky. Given the present economic conditions, do the Rabbonim have any suggestions for things that can be done to be more lenient with in order to reduce the significant Pesach expense?
There's so much food that it doesn't cost any more. I mean, the typical, you know, fruits and vegetables and meats and very wines or whatever, the eggs and the common foods don't cost any more than they do all year. But if someone wants special, high-priced matzah, in Tovi Olav Broch, it's a hiddur to get what you consider to be the most mehudadik of matzah. And so the only date would be to eat less of it. I found that Pesach, when we say there's a tremendous expense, what causes the added expense besides kalim, which we get for Pesach? You know, everyone has to have the same kalim for Pesach, for the 8 days of Pesach, like he has for a whole year. And today we have all kinds of different electrical kalim and microwaves and everything. So if you have those kalim, you have those vessels and instruments, you're talking about the food. There shouldn't be any greater expense, but I found a very interesting thing. that people for Pesach put off buying special luxurious foods for Pesach, for the Kovet, for the Simcha of the Yontif. No, it's a very important thing. But for a person who's constrained not to spend too much money, so maybe he could just buy one or two things as a special mark of distinction for the Yontif of Pesach, and not have a large amount for the whole Yontif. I don't think that there's really that much to do. What should we do on Pesach? Because there's a financial crunch. Go look for coolers. Go find certain heterim for things which we wouldn't ordinarily eat on Pesach. I can't see that would save any money, and I can't see that there's any need for it. And if there is, so then go take to the shul and get a package of Kimcha de Pesach. You know, I a speaker yesterday, or the day before, used a phrase which is very, you know, touching and pathetic. He said that there are many people in past years who were givers and now have to come on to the Pesach packages. Well, there's a certain Galgal HaChoizer in the world. If 1 year somebody needs to be helped, so then they should be helped. I would like to rephrase the question, Rabbi Safran, that you asked, and I would say perhaps we should think differently, that those people who have the wherewithal to help others should be extremely sensitive this Pesach and find their friends and relatives and neighbors and others and people in the community who may be under a tremendous economic stress, and maybe they lost their jobs, maybe their business suffered a lot, and maybe they're really, you know, it's tremendously pressured financially, and see, quietly find out and make sure that they have the things they need. That perhaps is more important. To give aitzes for people to look for coolers for Pesach is not going to solve any problems, but we should give aitzes to people to try to be extremely super sensitive to help others and to discover who needs help and you know, find out ways of doing it which wouldn't be offensive to the other person. That's the special avoider, I think, that this Pesach is endowed with more than others, the Manishtana HaPesach HaZeh Mikol HaTzochim, and maybe that's the Manishtana. We should go out of our way to find who needs help.
Very well put. If I may rephrase it, Yerushuscha, Rebbe, perhaps this year we need to do also a bedika for where we can do more chesed.
Mm-hmm. Good.
Rav Shechter, a number of questions that came from someone who I know to be a very big Baal Regesh. Is it proper to omit certain parts of the Magid in order to keep non-frum guests from getting bored?
I would think that yes. I would think you have to consult Talmud Chacham to know which parts of the Magid can be omitted. I would think that it is important to.
Is it proper to ignore eating the afikoman before chatzos in order to allow children to say more divrei Torah during Magid? Also, how adamant must one be to ensure that they eat the afikoman before chatzos if their host is seemingly oblivious to the time?
The Gemara points out that there's a machlekes hatanoim, whether you have to finish the afikoman bisman hazeh before chatzos. So many don't even try to make it before Chatzos. More correct is that you should try. The Shulchan Aruch, Rabbi Yosef Kai writes, you should try to finish the Afikoman before Chatzos. The Ramah writes for Ashkenaz, and you should try to finish all the Arba Kaisers before Chatzos.
Hallel.
The whole Hallel with the fourth Kais before Chatzos, yeah. So I would assume that this is part of Chinuch HaBanim. We should try it. If I'm not by someone else's Seder, if it's my Seder and it's my children and I have a little say, my wife has a say also, but if I have a little say, so I should try to convince my wife she shouldn't have too long a meal with too many courses. We should be mekatz in the meal. And I should guide my children that each one should not say such long devitar, and they should know this is part of the chinuch of the children. They should try to make it b'chatzos. Look, if the balabasta prepared a very elaborate meal, and she's going to feel insulted that the husband is going to leave out a couple of courses for the meal. So I think the poskim assume that. That's not right. We should farbeg on the chatzos. If you're visiting by someone else, so yeah, look, you have to make up your mind in advance. You have to negotiate with the host and try to figure out if they're not going to make chatzos. So don't go over there. If you're stuck, you have no choice. It's your parents or your in-laws. You have no choice. You have to go there. So you try to convince them that you make it by chatzos. As nisht is nisht. So we'll survive by having nothing coming after chatzos. You should be careful not to eat the matzah after chatzos. There are some communities closer to the North Pole where they really have a problem. They told me in Gateshead they really have a problem in other areas like that closer to, they really have a problem eating the matzah before chatzos. So that for sure. You should be careful to say al achilas matzah before chatzos. But if it's really a big shas hadchak, so we'll make al anafi come in after chatzos.
Perhaps
really?
Sometimes you could tell the children that I'd love to hear all the wonderful Torah that you have, and I'm going to hear it, but during the Neguna Mechad Miyadeya and Chagadya and all these wonderful, you know, post Hallel parts of the Haggadah, we'll make a special opportunity to say over all the time.
Maybe the children will be up.
On the daytime. The daytime
also.
Or the Yontif meals.
Mm-hmm.
Related to that as well, Rav Shechter, you mentioned it earlier. How should one resolve conflicts between one's personal minhagim and those of one's in-laws or of the host?
Let's say I marry a Sfardish girl, and my in-laws are serving kidneys. So I should not eat kidneys. Maybe I should try to convince them they shouldn't give me a hard time. They shouldn't put the kidneys on my plate. Otherwise it's going to be conspicuous that I'm not observing their minhagim. Yeah. You have to make up in advance. Look, you have to use chachma and make up in advance. Try to convince the balabas to do things in such a way to satisfy both his and my minhagim. To be yotzi, they call a sheet.
Seichel is an edel azach. Rav Shechter, Rav Belsky, how do I kosher a self-cleaning oven? What must I do different for a regular oven? I do believe we spoke of it last year, but if we can have a quick chazara.
I already answered the question. I said two words. I agree with Rav Shechter. I believe all you have to do is turn on the self-cleaning oven to full cycle. The self-cleaning oven will be completely burnt out, and if there's any discoloration or stain, that's nothing. That's some pigment that got in. But there's absolutely no material. It's all destroyed and burnt. Some people are afraid of the door. They say the door doesn't get as hot. I can't see how that could possibly be. The door is part of the same chamber, and the heat circulates throughout the chamber. And whatever heat you have in the rest of the chamber, you have in the door too. I think with this idea about the door came into being because the original self-cleaning ovens, you know, weren't as perfectly sealed. And sometimes food got between the two glass panels on the door. So you could see that piece of food, which is protected from the heat. And it's standing there, and it never got destroyed and burnt like everything else. So the illusion was created that the door doesn't have, somehow is heat-resistant door. But I don't think it's so. Just put the oven through a good clean and wipe out all the dust, and you have a Pesach Dikah oven.
Two shadows relating to kidneys, Rabelsky. If one uses an oven bag in their challenge pot and wants to make a kidneys challenge for Shabbos HaGadol, can one use a Pesach Dikah pot?
No. This year Shabbos HaGodol is 5 days before Pesach, so there's plenty of time to use the chometz tikkun. But when you have Yichveis chometz beginning on Sunday, so you use a Pesach tikkun cholent, potato, make a potato cholent. You know, to mess around with having food that might end up a little bit here and a little bit there. Somebody will lift up the bag and the stuff will spill out all over the place. You got to be careful if you want to have the house in a Pesach condition, because Shabbos HaGodol is Erev Pesach. So just make sure you have to have nothing except that challah which you eat in a very special, carefully protected way, so that it should be able to be flushed down the toilet, all the crumbs and all that. But you don't keep anything, even kidneys. Nothing should interfere with the comfort of the Pesach preparation. I remember a person came to our house and said that he's going to be our Shabbos guest, but he's a vegetarian, and we should serve him things which contain no meat at all. So my wife said, fine. She prepared two cholents, one with beans and potatoes, and the other one had the meat and the other stuff in it, separate pot, separate kelim, and he had his... spoke before about guests who have to be,
special
needs. Yeah. Try to take care of everyone, but the main thing is with a smile, that's all. If it's with a frown, it's not worth anything.
Relating to kidneys, of course, is a big issue with baby formulas. Rav Belsky, how must I segregate baby formula that is kidneys?
Baby formulas that are kidneys, you could just wash out the plate in the bathroom sink. If you have some bottle of ground up beans or peas or something like that, I think peas are popular machel by baby food. I just like to call attention to something that I think was mentioned in previous years. There's baby rice cereal. That rice cereal should never be used for Pesach. It's rice cereal, but it's made on the same equipment as barley cereal, an oat cereal or whatever. And there's tiny little flakes. And when that box of rice cereal is prepared, is packed, so there's numerous little tiny flakes of oat cereal there. They could be bottled, 1 in 1,000. But they'll become mixed in with the rest of the cereal, with the rice cereal, on Pesach. That's when they'll get mixed in, because they're whole, they're unmixed. They're independent flakes that are floating around in this box, and when the milk is poured, then it all becomes one mass. So there's a tarovis, which is created on Pesach, and the Pesach and the chometz will answer even b'mashahu. So be careful when you need the baby rice cereal to have either some special kosher Pesach production, which I believe is imported here from Eretz Yisrael, maybe, I'm not that certain, and or else just take the rice, the non-enriched rice, and cook it up and strain it like they did before they had prepared cereals. When we were kids, there were very few bottles with baby food. You took everything that was the adults ate and then put it through a grinder. They called it a foley mill in those days. And you ground it up and then strained it, and it was good for the baby. So you have to be a little innovative and prepare. But kidneys is no problem. You could feed kidneys to the baby without any compunctions. And if you need to wash out the spoon, or you get a special plastic spoon if it bothers you to wash it, plastic plate, there's no problem.
Several more Shilas Rebelsky about koshering. Firstly, my question is about pot handles. When koshering a pot or frying pan by the appropriate procedure of agola or even kal, how does one kosher the pot or pot handle? Does it need to be koshered?
Well, if it's one piece like you have with frying pan handles, which are generally welded onto the frying pan, so it's one extended piece, and we say that if that's the case, then the bliya, the absorption of chametz, which went into the pot, went into the handle as well. So whatever you're going to do to make the frying pan itself have liben kal, then do it to the handle. For the most part, those a real frying pan needs liben chomer. It doesn't need liben kal because if you used it with chomer stick of food, it was used directly over the fire where the food was touching the pot with nothing intervening. So, I mean, in the old days, so you would give it liben chomer. But I don't think that today anyone is bothered by that. They'll get the frying pan for Pesach. If you have to kasher a pot where there are plastic handles, so boil it in water, because a pot generally doesn't need libun. You can't make libun on plastic. And if it's a pot that you have to make libun kal or whatever, and there's no choice, so the handle could be boiled. After all, the Gemara talks about the Rav Ashi's knife. When he kashered the knife, and he wanted to kasher the blade in fire, so he put the blade into the fire, and the handle, which was wood, of course he couldn't put into the fire, and he covered it with some protective substance, tina, so it shouldn't be burnt by the fire. And then he peeled off that stuff and put it into boiling water. So the handle only needs boiling water. And the blade needed libun. We paskin, you don't need libun. Anyway, but tof kol tof, you see that you could kasher part of a kli with libun chomer over there. No chadata avidna, kein chadata, it's mamish a full libun. And the rest, just plain old-fashioned agol.
Rav Shech, there are many food and non-food items that I keep in my pantry year-round are actually kosher lePesach. Since they were not kept separate for Pesach, may I use them? If so, can I use open containers and bottles of kosher for Pesach items?
Open containers of foods that are kosher. Let's say I have Pesach Dika Matzah. So I have a box of Pesach Dika Matzah. I use it all year long. So that clearly the minig is that we don't use on Pesach. In fact, the minig used to be the Ravon. Is the days of the Bali Atesis used to correspond with the Rabbeinu Tam and the Rashbam. So he writes the minig always was that they made the Erev Echatzeris to be permitted to carry with a box of Pesach Dika Matzahs before Pesach. The next day of Pesach, they would burn it with the chametz. So he wonders why. Why did they burn it with the chametz? So he explains, because the Erev Chatzeres is only valid if all of the Jewish people who live in that area that's covered with the Erev have access to the matzahs and have a right to take the matzahs. So maybe somebody with his chametz digger fingers put in his hand into the box of matzahs and took out a matzah. So he said, the minhag used to burn the box of matzahs. I don't know if we have that minhag today to burn. Some people do have it, to burn the box matzah. But certainly you don't, if it's an open container, we're afraid that maybe we put in chametz digger fingers, maybe there's chametz. But if you have some canned goods, or you have a box of something that's kosher lePesach and it's closed, and it was sitting all year long next to other things, so you just wipe off the outside of the can, the outside of the box, and shine. You don't have to be concerned. Maybe the chametz was nivla through and through.
Rabelsky, does a water pump or a water urn that is used for hot water on Shabbos that only has water in it need to be kashered?
Well, it should. It doesn't really need to be kashered if nothing got into it, and if the children can't open it up and stick something into it, then there's no reason why you should be afraid that any chametz got into it. But the spout and the outside comes in contact with all the food in the kitchen. People go over to there and and touch it with the hands that are holding cookies and cake, and you know, someone wants a cup of coffee with the other piece of cake in his hand. That stuff needs to be really scrubbed and cleaned very, very well. As far as having a blia come from chametz below that should rise up and get into the spout, the halacha is that, you know, if boiling water falls down on something cold or into a cold cup, we're not worried that something on the bottom rose up and got into the keli on top. It's only the opposite. If something cold fell into a very, very hot pot, so we're choshish that some blia came from the bottom and went up into the pot. Nevertheless, when it comes to Pesach, we're choshish even for the opposite, that if there was something hot that went into a cold kli, so we're choshish, we're afraid that the steam from the bottom went up into the top. So that spout, which is constantly pouring into all kinds of things, for the whole year long, there's really no shash, no matter what it poured into, milchik, fleishik. But for Pesach, you should try to kash it. And the way to kash it would be to allow boiling water to flow through it, which is what happens to it all the time, of course, and to, at the same time, or later, to pour boiling water all over the outside of it, so that it should have iri reichen on the outside and real reichen on the inside, and that's the best kashering that could be made with it. You know, it's not always easy for people to have a special urn for Pesach. You don't always have where to put it. So it could be cleaned and used for Pesach. And if someone's worried that the surface should be kashered because hot lokshen or hot food got onto the surface, so wrap it up in some aluminum foil or something just to keep the surface away from food.
The woman who asked the question in this regard began her email, which she sent just about an hour or so ago, with a gratifying statement: I'm looking forward to another great OU webcast today, and I'm glad that we are having a great webcast today. These webcasts have been very well received. We've had a lot of very, very positive feedback and constant requests for more. This person asks, Rav Schechter, does milk and meat bought before Pesach require Pesach certification?
Milk is not a problem. In Shulchan Aruch, they have a whole discussion about the possibility of the cows eating chametz b'Pesach. I don't think they feed chametz now, but even if the cows are eating chametz b'Pesach, so then it's a shaila about the milk that comes out on Pesach. Maybe Zev Zagarim is considered a mashu, but the milk that you buy before Pesach, even if the cows were actually eating chametz, it's not a problem. They're careful not to allow any chametz to fall into the milk when they're homogenizing it and when they're pasteurizing it and so on. About the meat also, you have to find out whether if you have a butcher shop, so maybe the butcher is eating cookies when he's chopping your meat. But if you have packaged meat and it comes from a place where they're very careful, they don't allow them to nash on any sandwiches while they're preparing the meat, I don't see any problem.
There are now many products made from egg matzahs, tam-tams, and the like. Are any of these acceptable for Ashkenazim?
Egg matzahs, we have the minhag mentioned in Shulchan Aruch that we don't allow egg matzahs only for chayla muskenim, only if it's a big shasatrak. We have machmer for the opinion that maybe this is considered the chametz nuksha, maybe that's the beginning of the chametz process. We don't allow. Rabbi Aaron Soloveitchik was once confronted on his streitz matzahs. He put this in Hebrew, Mutarak L'Cholim L'Skeim. So they had Tarumas, why doesn't he put it in English? Most of the American people don't understand the Hebrew. So he defended his position. He said he thought about it for a while. quite a while in advance, and he said in Streitz Matzes, he said that they introduced a system whereby he thinks that his egg matzes are even mutter according to the minig of the Ashkenazim not to eat egg matzes. He said because it never sits without any hisaskas at all. He says the dough is always either being shaken or moving, or he introduced a clapping machine that just bangs the matzes to prevent it from sitting there without any hisaskas. But still, the minig was that for those who know how to read Hebrew, the minig is that you still don't eat it unless you're chol miskein. Tom Tams also, what do they have? They also have May Paris in them. So the same chumra would apply. Yeah.
Someone recently suggested to me that a future webcast should be regarding the re-education and focus on appropriate brachas that need to be made on so very many foods, some foods of which were not known in previous generations. A very nice question here of Belsky. This concerns brachas for Pesach foods. I don't know if this is appropriate for the webcast, she writes, but with so many products and ingredients made with matzah, it's hard to know which ones require hamotzi and which ones are mizonos. Is there some way to distinguish these products? Nice question.
I would like to know myself. As an aside, Svar, they make mizonos on matzah a whole year long, except on Pesach when they make a moitzi. Because a whole year it's considered a wafer, a cracker, which is one of the three shittas. And they didn't use it as a bread any time outside of Pesach. We make a moitzi on it all year long because in the European countries, and here in America too, it's customary to eat matzah as a staple, as a substitute for bread often during a meal. But to take bread, to take matzah, or bread for that matter, and to turn it from a moitzi to mezoinus, it's a little complicated. If it was cooked or in boiling water, but the large pieces were more than the kezias, then it retains the moitzi no matter what. If the pieces are smaller than the kezias, then it all depends. If they're smaller than the kezias, so if it's cooked, then automatically it becomes a mezoinus. But if it's not cooked, but it's just soaked, it has to be soaked long enough for it to lose its turisa denama, that means to lose the texture, the appearance of bread. That's a question that comes up in the preparation of challah kugel. Challah kugel is made by soaking and ripping apart the old challah, and some people use pieces that are greater than the kezias and some that are smaller than the kezias. And those that are greater than the kezias, that retains a moitzi, no matter what. If they're smaller, then it depends if there was cooking done to it, or if there was soaking done to it, and cooking automatically becomes a mezoinus. However, it's quite possible that even if it was pieces less than the kezias, and the pieces were cooked, and therefore it should all be a mezoinus. Afal pikein, it still could be a moitzi, simply because when it's put back to bake, so it's again a fresh baked product which doesn't have anything in there that should prevent it from becoming a moitzi all over again.
No.
Unless the ingredients that are put into the challah kugel are the ingredients that would make the flour and whatever else goes into a bread into a cake. For instance, if there are eggs and sugar and raisins and that kind of thing. And I'll tell you, I had my education in this many, many years ago. I had two babas, Aleihem HaSholem. One was born here in America, but she had got her recipes from her Hungarian antecedents, grandparents who came here a long, long time ago. And the other one was Litvisha. And they both made chalukah. They both came down to the house and made chalukah. And one was the Litvisha chalukah, the salt and pepper kind. And the other one was a Hungarian chalakugel, filled with eggs and raisins and sugar and all kinds of stuff like that. And they both made it by shredding apart the challah into pieces that were less than kizayas. And it was soaked or cooked or whatever it is. But one was a moitzi, because when it was reconstituted, it got back into bread condition. There was not that much pepper and salt that should really change it. So it got a moitzi all over again, and the other one was a mezainet. So I had some very interesting education in this field from a source that most people are not privileged to have. On Pesach, you can have a machol, a commonly eaten Pesach food, in those houses where they eat gebrokt, which is matzah that's soaked in liquid. And it's known as matzah brei. Matzah brei, take a couple of flat pieces of matzah and soak them and put various ingredients in there and fry them in a pan, and they make a very delicious machol. Well, there again, sometimes the pieces are a kezias, sometimes they are less than a kezias. And if they're less than a kezias, it depends what's done to them, whether they're cooked or they're just soaked and fried. There's two shittas. The machlokes with the tikkun, frying in oil, is like cooking or like soaking. And depending on the ingredients, that matzah brei could be a moitzi or it could be a mezoinus. So you could use the food as a very successful educational tool on Pesach, if that's when you make such kind of food.
Today with visual aids.
Yeah. Today we have plastic and freezers, so the challah doesn't all become hard like a rock and dry, and you don't eat that much challah kugel like it used to be eaten. But that's one food. As far as everything else, there's food made from matzah meal. If it's matzah meal was turned into a knedel, well, you have your big, serious question. A knedel is a borer min mezoinus, right? But on the other hand, there have been a time held that a knedel, which is made with a good, thick dough, made from the matzah meal, fine. But if and it was boiled in water, and each of the pieces that went into it is less than a kezias, okay, let's say each knedel is less than a kezias, without discussing the crumbs that go into making the knedel, let's avoid that question. So you might think that, well, here we have a mezoinus for sure, right? On the other hand, there have been a tamel that if it's boiled with a thick dough in water, so it's a moitzi all over again. And in Shulchan Aruch it says that when you eat food like that, you should only eat it terchasude. So then you have a question. You could make a mezoinus, but if you want to be a reshamayim and need a terchasude, so then make a moitzi on something else and eat that during the meal. And what else there is, I don't know. I'm not up to date with, you mentioned, Rabbi Safran, that it's all because of the variety of foods that in today's special food market that the shilas come up, and I believe I disappointed everybody by just discussing old ancient foods that were around in our grandmother's, great-grandmother's time.
Next year, I'll bring you all the updated foods. You mentioned gebrokt. Somebody just sent in a shaila before, Ravelsky, whether or not it's gebrokt to put jelly on matzah.
Many people don't consider gebrokt any matzah made with just made pears, pure eggs or pure apple juice that has no water added to it. The some people are noyeg that they'll take any matzah that's soaked in any liquid and call it kibrot. But for those people for whom kibrot doesn't include anything but water, so in that case, I doubt if the water in the jelly, when you make jelly, you add water to the fruit naturally, there's some water in this jelly. But that water doesn't really count as water, because it's been absorbed into the jelly beforehand. And the truth is, if a little bit water got mixed into apple juice, I'll be then, it's not considered water any longer if it came in before, while the apple juice was being processed. We try to avoid having any water in our apple juice, which is used to make the special egg matzahs that were discussed beforehand. But the truth is that the water became bottled to the jelly before. It doesn't have a din of water. So it all depends. If you're in a house where kibrotz is not tolerated even to the degree that any type of liquid is when it comes in contact with matzah, so you're choshesh and called kibrotz. In that case, I don't know about the jelly. Some jellies are very stiff and very solid. They're really not liquidy at all. Some are a little liquidy. So I suppose it's totally in that. We don't have that minig, and I don't know if people are really makbid on it, but those who are makbid on kibrotz, they are so careful sometimes with the matzah that they'll never eat a matzah without wrapping it up in a napkin, in a cloth napkin or something, making sure that nothing whatsoever in the whole world gets in contact with that matzah. Which I suppose jelly would be included.
Rovelsky, what is the status of bagged lettuce and cabbage for Pesach, as long as it has a good hechsher year long?
I'm not aware of any Pesach concern with the bagged lettuce. I know that the concern is to see that the bugs and the insects are washed out of them, or that they don't have insects to begin with. But that there's any non-kosher Pesach material that gets into the processing, I'm not aware that there is. Would you have heard of that kind of stuff? No.
And also related to this, to Sugya Arichta, but just to give the highlights, Rabelsky, how should I check my romaine lettuce to make sure it is free of bugs? And if I can inject a comment that as we are here conducting this pre-Pesach webcast, we're putting the finishing touches on an outstanding OU Kosher DVD on for home use, for homemakers, for home kitchens, on the proper way of checking vegetables. This will be out in several weeks in Yitashem. I think during our last webcast I made mention that it was being prepared, and Baruch Hashem it is finalized and completed, and I think it will be probably the best in the field that will enable homes to maintain the high level of kashrus the checking of vegetables deserves. But in regard to romaine lettuce, Rabelsky?
Okay. long before in the ancient world, before they had cell phones and fax machines and bagged lettuce, which all you have to do is open up the bag and pull it out, you have, lo and behold, bug-free, kosher lettuce, insect-free. We used to have to be boydik, half the year of Pesach was spent, or the day before, in checking through romaine lettuce. The secret to checking romaine lettuce is the following. Two facts. One fact is that lettuce leaves, romaine lettuce especially, are translucent. Translucent means they're not transparent. You can't see through them what's doing on the other side, but it does let the light through. The light goes straight through the leaf, not the appearance of the objects on the other side. Fact number two is that bugs, even the little tiny pale yellow, green, light green colored bugs, are all opaque. The light does not go through the bug. With that in mind, you take a light. It could be the ceiling light, it could be a desk lamp, or If you're really good at it, you'll have the light box that we use, that the professionals use, and artists pack with the light inside. Make sure that the light is on the other side of the letters. You're looking at the letters, and the light is shining through it from the other side. Hold the letters between your eye and the light. That light will shine straight through the letters. And the whole letters will be translucent. The light will go through every spot. If there's a spot that's dark, that means the light's not going through that spot. Examine that spot. It may be a bug. You may not notice it, because if you look at it, it may just look just like the lettuce leaf, maybe the same color. And you scan over the whole lettuce leaf very carefully, and you wouldn't pick up that bug. But once the light is shining through the leaf from the other side, you have to pick up the bug, because it just stands out. It's dark, and everything else is so light. Sometimes just a piece of dirt, so you flick it off. Then you take the leaf and turn it over, and do it to the other side, because you can't do it to both sides at once. You won't see that black shadow if the bug is on the other side. It won't be as clear and distinct as when it's on your side. So that's the way to be bodek the vegetables. If you develop a system and you're good at it, you could prepare romaine lettuce enough for 25 guests in very little time, as long as you wash it off first, shake out the water, and then check it through using that method. There may be in romaine lettuce an infestation of aphids, and aphids very often are the same color as the lettuce. And they hide in these curls, the regular iceberg lettuce. They don't know where to hide, so a good washing will get them off if you wash it very well with some spray. But romaine lettuce, they get into the curls of romaine lettuce, and yet you could get them all off if you just use that method of having the light on the other side of the lettuce. And when it comes to celery, which you might want to use for karpas, cut off the little leaves at the top and brush off the bottom, and keep your eyes open and peeled for one single kind of bug. And that's called a leaf miner. Miner is from the Shayrish to mine, to burrow under the surface of the leaf.
With an E.
E, M-I-N-O-E-R, M-I-N-E-R, miner. Like the miners' union. And the inside, the concave surface of the celery leaf, sometimes has this leaf miner. All you have to do is to look, and you'll catch it in a split second, that there shouldn't be a squiggly line in the concave surface of the celery stalk. If there is, so you could either throw it out, cut it off at that point where the line ends, or just go to the end of the line and dig with a knife, and you'll find the villain, the bug itself, will be there, and that's the end of it. It's really, and what else is there special to be boided for on Pesach? I don't know. Everything else is the same like all year round.
How can we have a pre-Pesach webcast this year and not make mention of the great schus, an opportunity that we will have to recite the Birkas HaChama? So one asked the question, Rav Schechter, should one say the Birkas HaChama prior to burning the chametz?
It's a good shayla. I didn't even think about it. Usually we assume Torah v'sheinah Torah, Torah kaidam. Is this called Torah? Every year we burn the chametz. There's only once every 28 years. Mustama should burn the chametz first. The only thing is we have a problem. All of us who rely on the mechiras chametz of the rabbi, so if we're burning the chametz right after Shachris, we have so many units of chametz, and we're burning a little bit of chametz, and we still have 99% of the chametz left. Then the last bit of chametz, we rely on the rabbi to sell, so we're not really yotzei the mitzvah of bir chametz. And many have the insistence, if you're relying on the rabbi's mechiras chametz, that you should wait to burn your leftover chametz after you think that the rabbi already sold 99% of the chametz. So the last bit of chametz that you have left, that you burn. So then there's no issue of Tadav Shein and Tadav Tadav Kaidim, because I'm not interested in performing the both mitzvahs right now. After Shachris, I'm only interested in reciting Brichas HaChama. And the burning of the Chametz, I'm not interested in doing it now. I want to have a Chametz Digger breakfast. I'm not ready to burn the Chametz Bechla. I want to have a Chametz Digger breakfast. I'm going to go home first. Then I'm going to burn the Chametz later. Yeah. Whenever you're not interested in performing the both mitzvahs right now, then the rule of Tadav Shein and Tadav does not apply. I would think that after Shachris, we should say the Brichas HaChama, go home and eat our breakfast with the Chametz, then burn the Chametz later.
And also this year, Avelsky, we have to remind the audience, we'll have to make an Erev Tafshilin. So, the typical Shaila, somebody so Torah on Erev Pesach, with all the Inyone Pesach, with all the preparations for the Seder and so forth, when he comes to Shul, and are gedenkt, he didn't make Erev Tafshilin. So now what?
But this year it's not a major problem because he could make an Erev Tafshilin on Thursday and say if today's Yontif, so then I'll be cooking tomorrow for Choyl, and because it's Choyl, Friday will be Choyl, 2 days Yontif means that there's a Sofik. One of the days is Yontif and one of the days is Choyl. We have to treat both days equally, except for when it comes to Choylim or Mesim. But outside of that, we can't differentiate between Yontif Ishan and Yontif Sheni. We can't make a Zilzul. But we could make this special tonight. We could make a special tonight and make the Erev Tafshilin on the first day and say that if today is Yontif, so then the Erev should be nothing and tomorrow's cooking will be muta because tomorrow is really Choyl. But if tomorrow is Yontif and I can't cook, so then today is Choyl and then the Erev should be an Erev. So I'll have my Erev Tafshilin, which I'm supposed to do, and according to many poskim, you do it with a bracha when you make an Erev, even though there's a 50% chance that it's not an Erev. And what if Yontif is Friday, and then comes Shabbos, and you don't have a chance to make such a tnai? Well, you know, you have very often in a section where people live, a Rav who is sort of achroi on the town, I guess if you want to make New York City into one big town, then you could do it for the whole city. But if a person, if the Rav is mizake, that the Erev should be good for all those who forgot to make the Erev, if the person who forgot ba'oynes, he just didn't procrastinate and keep putting it off, knowing that he should make an Erev, and then the last minute, that's not called ba'oynes. Just like the Gemara tells about the man who forgot 2 years in a row to make the Erev and he didn't take the precautions to remind himself about the need to make an Erev. So he's also not called an onus. But the mezake the Erev for all those people who forgot. Sometimes, all balabatim, others besides the Rav does it. But you got to know how to do it, because to be mezake for others, you got to do it with someone who's not oichel al shulchancha, and you have to tell him to be zeichel for the other. So it's good to make an Erev. There should be people in every section who should make an Erev with tchia, and it should be good for the people who forgot and who actually forgot, not just postponed it and were lazy. But this year you really don't have the problem at all. Yeah, that's right. The last days of Pesach, what is that? Wednesday and Thursday, right? Last days, we don't have any problem.
I want to thank our Rabbonim HaGaonim, the OU Poskim, Rav HaGaon Rav Yisrael Belsky, and Rav HaGaon Rav Shosh Shechter, for this very, very, very outstanding, informative, and learned webcast. I want to again remind our audience that many, many questions, particularly relating to kashering and other Pesach issues, were discussed last year. They're archived on last year's pre-Pesach webcast. Please look for it on the OU Kosher Radio, where you will find the last year's webcast, as well as practically 140 kosher tidbits relating with every aspect and concern of kashrus. I also want to bring to the attention of our audience that the OU has this year issued a much enhanced guide for Pesach. I'm holding it in my hand. It's much enhanced with new information, much new content, coordinated by my chaverim at OU Kosher, Rabbi Nachum Rabinowitz, Rabbi Yosef Grossman, Rabbi Yonason Kaganov, and of course Rabbi David Polsky, Rabbi Shmuel Singer, and Rabbi Gavriel Price. There's some very, very excellent pieces there that have been added to the lengthy list of OU Kosher certified product for Pesach. And as we speak of the coming of Yom Tov Pesach, I also want to draw your attention to the fact that OU Press has just recently issued a Haggadah with a commentary, with the insight, with the brilliance of Moreinu Arav Yosef Dov Halevi Soloveitchik Zecher Tzadik Livracha the Rav, that has been edited by our own Rabbi Menachem Ginak, the rabbinic administrator and CEO of OU Kosher. It's something that certainly speaks for its title, that your Yontif could indeed be exalted as the title Exalted Evening, this Haggadah for Pesach, which hopefully you will get before Yontif of Pesach. Again, yeshar koach to our poskim, to the rabbonim, those of you who've been in with us before, those of you who are here with us for the first time know that if your question has not been answered or if you have additional questions, please do email them to me at safrane@ou.org, and they will be responded to during the next few days. And for this, I thank our chaver, our very distinguished Rabbi Eli Gerstein, for putting in a lot of time and effort and knowledge into responding to those questions and consultation with our poskim. To all of you, to Klal Yisrael, lechakosh v'sameach, we should be zoche to a geula shleima b'me'era. Thanks so very much.
Amen.